Welcome to Music History Monday for October 5th, 2020. I'm Bob Greenberg, and the title for today's podcast is Christoph Willibald Gluck and Orfeo ed Euridice. If you haven't already, please consider joining me on my subscription site at patreon.com/robertgreenbergmusic, where I blog, vlog, podcast, pontificate, review, and bloviate 4 to 6 times a week. We mark the premiere performance on October 5th, 1762, 258 years ago today, of Christoph Willibald Gluck's opera, Orfeo ed Euridice, at the Burgtheater in Vienna, in the presence of Empress Maria Theresa, her very self. The history of opera is not unlike the history of the movies or television. It is a medium of great artistic and intellectual potential, cyclically debased by its potential for huge monetary gain. The first operas, composed between roughly 1600 and 1640, were courtly entertainments called drammi per musica, meaning dramas with music. And that's precisely what they were. Stage dramas in which words and actions were deepened a gazillionfold by setting them to music. Such entertainments were literate and sophisticated, and the great master of the genre was Claudio Monteverdi, 1567 to 1643. The first public opera house, San Cassiano, opened in that singular tourist destination of its time, Venice, in 1637. The paying public that attended San Cassiano, as well as the other public opera houses that opened in Vienna in its wake, didn't want literary sophistication, oh no. They wanted spectacle, sex, violence, slapstick comedy, virtuosic singing, and wild special effects. Like the competing Cirque du Soleil shows in Las Vegas. The more outlandish the entertainment, the more derrieres would fill the seats. The literary veracity of early court opera gave way in these public operas to spectacle and dramatic dreck. Storylines revolved around mistaken identity. Dramatic integrity gave way to an endless succession of different scenes, as many as 15 or 20 different scenes in a single act, writes the opera historian Donald Grout, quote, "Lavish scenic backgrounds added to the spectacle. Pastoral idols, dreams, oracles, incantations, spectral apparitions, descents of gods, shipwrecks, sieges, and battles filled the stage. In particular, the machines, ingenious mechanical contrivances for the production of sudden miraculous changes and supernatural appearances, attained a degree of development never since surpassed." Unquote. Comparing such a Venetian operatic spectacle to a literate drama per musica is like comparing a Marvel Comics movie to one by Ingmar Bergman. And while the opera-going public loved them, that public was, after all, getting precisely what it wanted and paid for, critics did indeed object to what they perceived as the wanton destruction of operatic art in favor of spectacle and monetary gain. Writing much later, in 1956, Joseph Kerman observed, quote, "Venetian opera had thrown dignity into the canals. It was the worst period of Italian opera," unquote. Many highbrow contemporaries felt the same way, and thus began, in the late 17th and early 18th centuries, the first of a series of reform movements meant to restore to Italian opera a degree of dramatic gravity and literary substance. We generally call the product of this first operatic reform, Italian opera seria, or serious opera. The movement was spurred on by two poets, that is, librettists, those people who write the words for operas. Apostolo Zeno, 1661 to 1750, and Pietro Metastasio, 1698 to 1782. The operatic reform movement began at ground zero of operatic excess in Venice during the late 17th century and was spearheaded by the Venetian-born poet slash librettist Apostolo Zeno. Zeno's avowed mission was to purge Venetian opera of all the extraneous crap that had become standard operatic fare: comic interludes, dog and pony acts, excessive visual spectacle, and the endless and dramatically destructive demands made by the singers themselves. Zeno proposed to achieve this by writing libretti that stayed on dramatic point and that celebrated nobility and noble sentiment. In order to better control dramatic pacing and the endless demands of singers, Zeno created something of a formula in his libretti by building his scenes around an opening recitative, half-spoken, half-sung recitation, followed by a concluding aria, after which the singer would take his or her bows and exit the stage. Zeno had ample opportunity to put his ideas about opera reform into action. In 1718, at the age of 50, he was appointed imperial poet and librettist in Vienna. It was a position he held for 11 years, until 1729, when he was replaced by a 31-year-old Roman-born poet and librettist named Pietro Antonio Domenico Bonaventura Trapassi, who wrote under the pen name Metastasio, 1698 to 1782. Metastasio brought the operatic reform movement begun by Zeno to its logical conclusion. In doing so, Metastasio, who was so highly respected by his contemporaries that he was actually compared to Dante and Homer, created a literary template that became standard opera seria procedure for the next 100 years. He wrote roughly 60 libretti, which were set to music over 800 times by more than 300 composers, including Vivaldi, Handel, Gluck, J.C. Bach, and Mozart. Mozart's last opera, La Clemenza di Tito, The Mercy of Titus, of 1791, sets a Metastasio libretto. Opera historian Donald Grout encapsulates Metastasio's opera seria template. Quote, "As a rule, these works presented a conflict of human passions in an action based on some story from an ancient Greek or Latin author. They made use of the conventional cast of two pairs of lovers and subordinate personages, and quite often brought in a favorite 18th century character, the magnanimous tyrant. The course of the action gave occasion for introducing varied scenes, pastoral or martial, solemn ceremonies, and the like. The resolution of the drama often turned on a deed of heroism or sublime renunciation by one of the principal characters." Grout continues, "There were three acts, cast almost unvaryingly in the form of alternating recitatives and arias. The action was developed in dialogue in the recitatives, while each aria represented what might be called a dramatic soliloquy, in which a principal actor of the preceding scene would give expression to appropriate feelings or comments about the particular situation then existing. There were occasional duets, but few larger ensembles and very few simple choruses." Unquote. We should file Metastasio's reforms under the heading, "Nice Try, But No Fly." Sadly, but predictably, Metastasio's attempt to legislate dramatic integrity through formulaic standardization had the opposite effect. Metastasio could get away with the predictability of his template because he was a poet of genius. But other librettists could not, and their libretti, based on Metastasio's model, were hopelessly stiff and predictable. As both nature and the opera stage abhor a vacuum. It was, once again, the singers who filled the dramatic void. The overwhelming interest in Metastasian Reform opera became the arias and the extravagant manner in which they were sung. Rather than alleviate the problems caused by the singers, the reforms of Zeno and Metastasio paradoxically made them worse. Sir Donald Francis Tovey points out that, quote, Metastasio's scheme was fatally easy for other librettists to emulate and for composers with small talents to set to music, and it did not stimulate the higher faculties of great composers, while great and small were equally at the mercy of the singers, unquote. And so, it became necessary to reform the reform operas, which is where Maestro Gluck comes in. He was born in Bavaria, in today's southern Germany, and raised in Bohemia, in today's Czech Republic. While we still do not know if Gluck's native language was German or Czech, we do know that he composed operas in Italian and French and split his career between Vienna and Paris. By the time Gluck composed his Orfeo ed Euridice in 1762, he had come to the conclusion that the formulas of Metastasian opera seria were about as useful as a cold sore on a first date. In setting the legend of Orpheus and Eurydice to music, Gluck sought to achieve what he called beautiful simplicity. Working with the Italian librettist Ranieri di Calzabigi, 1714-1795, who went on to become Gluck's longtime collaborator, Gluck created an opera that, while still grand in its scenery and dramatic impact, embodied his reforms, which meant creating an opera in which the story, the drama, was more important than the star singers who performed it. First and foremost, this meant doing away with anything that smacked of predictable formula, thus allowing the storyline and the music to unfold naturally and without artifice. That meant doing away with dry or secco recitative, that's recitation accompanied only by a harpsichord, which to Gluck's mind and ear merely broke up the action. It meant eliminating any opportunities for singers to extemporize by removing the repetitions within arias that encouraged such improvisation. It meant composing simpler, more direct melodies that employed syllabic settings, one pitch per syllable, that made the words much easier to understand and more emotionally and dramatically direct. It meant blurring the distinction between recitative and aria, both of which were now accompanied by the orchestra. In 1766, Gluck summed up his thinking when he wrote, quote, "My intention was to purify music from all the abuses which have crept into Italian opera through the vanity of the singers and the excessive compliance of the composers, and have made the most splendid and beautiful of all arts the most ridiculous and boring. I tried, therefore, to bring musicians back to their real task of serving the poetry by intensifying the expression of emotion and the appeal of every situation without interrupting the plot or weakening it by excessive ornamentation," unquote. As it turns out, Gluck's Orfeo ed Euridice is the first modern opera, the oldest opera to be part of the standard operatic repertoire. That is a testament to its gorgeous music and dramatic veracity. Gluck's operas became the essential models for many of the next generation of opera composers, most notably one Johann Wolfgang Chrysostomus Gottlieb Mozart, who was an impossibly precocious six-year-old when Orfeo ed Euridice received its premiere. Writing in 1935, the English musicologist Martin Cooper describes the constant pendulum swings of opera history this way. Quote, "Opera is constructed of three elements, the musical, the literary, and the spectacular. And at different times, each of these three elements has, in fact, gained an undue supremacy over the other two. For this reason, the history of opera is the history of a series of reformations and counter-reformations, no two countries and no two epochs agreeing on the role that each element should ideally play in the constitution of the whole. Neither evolutionary nor unified, it is the history of perpetually reoccurring schools of thought, one never victorious over the other, though occasionally gaining the majority of popular opinion. Unquote. We would observe that the most artistically successful opera composers, Gluck, Mozart, Verdi, and Wagner chief among them, are those whose operas achieve that hard-won balance between the musical, the literary, and the spectacular. For lots more on this fascinating history of opera, I would implore you to check out my Great Courses survey, How to Listen to and Understand Great Opera, which can be examined and downloaded at robertgreenbergmusic.com. Thank you. To sample and download one or all of my many courses on subjects musical produced by the Great Courses / The Teaching Company, please visit my website at robertgreenbergmusic.com.